Okay. It is a great pleasure to be here and an honor. And I want to begin with some intellectual debts. I owe enormous debts to my Toronto origins to two Donalds. I must say, the other Donald here will probably be able to tell me why Coxeter was Donald, where Donald was fitted into the initials. Ah, okay. I knew he was always referred to. They're the ones who you'll see their handiwork indirectly in what I'm going to do. Coxeter taught me geometry and made me appreciate its beauty. And Don taught me about the structure of models, although I don't think I understood all of it at the time. I'm not sure I still do. We were just talking before about a joint project that we have going, but also kindled my interest in statistical inference. And then Fred Mosteller pointed it toward contingency tables, and in the inference sense, got me to be a Bayesian. And all of those things will be reflected in today's talk. I'm going to do two talks. And they fit together here for me, and I'll, but there's a gulf between them. I'm going to describe work for that for me has begun in each instance with tables of counts or contingency tables, but from two very different perspectives. And what I'll do is I'll indicate some of the mathematical ideas that I've been exploiting in doing it, and how this ties to practice. Because much of my interest is driven by the practical aspects. So, in the first part, I'm going to focus largely on very small tables and talk about different ways to think about characterization. And there's a lot of mathematics that lies behind it, but especially mathematics of algebraic geometry, although I didn't appreciate when I first started to do this the extent to which what I was doing fit with the modern algebraic geometry. But my motivation for doing it is high-dimensional problems, and I'll give you a medium-dimensional problem as the example because it fits on the screen. And it's really driven my interests and a lot of my work in disclosure limitation. So here's the example I'm going to play with in the first part. It comes from a clinical trial for the effectiveness of an analgesic drug. There's an active treatment, a placebo. The data come from two different centers. And there was randomization for two different statuses of illness, and then we have a three-category response structure, and I'm going to treat those as unordered for the purposes of today. So what I'm really going to focus on, this always happens to me, my beautiful pictures get washed out. Well, I'll still do some of it. For contingency tables, the key thing is that the space of interest is a simplex of dimension one less than the number of cells. So here, there are 24 cells, and so it's a 25-dimensional simplex. And there's a space for random variables, and for the observed values, there's a corresponding simplex, and the values that the random variables take in that simplex are the lattice points, and then there's a parallel parameter space. And it's sort of shifting back and forth between these that exploits the link to algebraic geometry. And I'm going to look at 2x2 tables because we can look at them. I actually have a program that rotates them around, but I don't have a lot of time to do it. But looking at tetrahedrons is something that I learned from the first Donald. And he used to stand back and say how lovely things were. And indeed, there are lots of interesting features here. So on the left is a typical sample point. On the right is the corresponding parametric structure. And for our purposes, probabilities are positive, not simply non-negative. And the counts are constrained to lie in a simplex with that total, and the corresponding probabilities lie in a simplex where the probabilities add to 1. What I'm being interested in is different ways to think about characterizing the parameter space and then transferring that to properties of the sample space. And the best known characterization is the one that we teach everybody in the first statistics class. So everybody has learned that the joint probability can be factored as a product of a marginal and a conditional. And it can go either way. And there's something a little tricky here when we go to look at the geometry, which is normally we talk about the probability of y given that x is equal to a value little x. And I'm going to vary something in a different kind of way when I look at the geometry. But this is the simple characterization, and it's the one that we usually begin with. But it's also well known that the two conditionals, which I've expressed here in terms of those probabilities, also characterize the joint. And in high dimensions, this is known as the Hammersley-Clifford theorem, and it's used in spatial statistical problems extensively. And here's this geometry thing that I was mentioning. What I'm interested here is in varying x and looking at the locus of the probability of y given x. Now, that's not looking at a conditional because normally the conditional fixes x. And so I'm changing x and then I'm looking at the new values of y and I keep going. And they correspond to lines on a surface. And that doubly ruled surface plays a variety of roles in contingency tables. I must say that I long ago made the geometry picture. What I didn't understand until the last year was that the rulings were these conditionals. And the conditionals play a key role in how to think about the algebraic geometry structure. So what about doing something else? Well, an example of something else is to take a conditional and a marginal, but the wrong marginal. Before I took the probability of x and the probability of y given x, and now I'm going to take the probability of y and the probability of y given x. And it turns out for the 2x2 table that that's unique. And so that determines the joint. And what I've got here is that line, that's the conditional, and the marginal corresponds to looking at a plane, and the plane intersects the line and a point. And now I want to shift to models, which are sort of the bedrock of what we do with contingency tables. And in a log linear model, the one way to choose the parameterization for the log of the cell probabilities is a decomposition into an interaction effect. I've lost my pointer in my bag. Do we have? Ah, beautiful. Thank you. It's much easier than going. Thank you. Very faint. I'll point. That's okay. I'll give you a battery later. Okay. So the interaction term U12 corresponds to this nice surface that we were looking at before. And then we think about main effects for rows and for columns. And what we saw before was the surface of independence where I set that interaction effect equal to zero. And that's a hyperbolic paraboloid. And so it captures something about dependence, U12, and in fact we can rewrite it in terms of the cell probabilities as a function of the odds ratio. The odds ratio in statistics has been a traditional way to look at interactions in 2x2 tables. And people normally have thought that the other two parameters, the U is just a normalizing constant because probabilities have to add to one. But the other two parameters do something more than measure marginal effects. In fact, you can redefine the parameters in terms of things that look like odds ratios. And in fact, I can make U look like the other ones here. By using a Hadamard-like representation. And so what we've really got is three odds ratios, which means I have three surfaces. And it's their intersections that I can think about. So I can also specify the joint distribution using both sets of one-way marginal totals and the odds ratio. That is margins and interaction, or I can do it by specifying these three different odds ratios that I just showed you, or I can begin to mix and match, and I can begin to think about statistical models that come from restricting values on one or more of these parameters in different ways. So the traditional way is to put get independence by setting alpha equal to zero and focusing on subspaces. But there are other versions of this where I can choose other values of the odds ratios and look at this in other ways. And this is where the geometry of the algebraic geometry representation really comes in, because what we're dealing with here is a representation for an ideal characterized by three polynomials which look like they're directly related to those three odds ratios. And that means that I can also look at the ideal that corresponds to a pair of them, and the locus of it is in fact a hyperbola running over values of the third one. And suddenly there are interesting features now about what we can say about the values of the points lying on that hyperbola. One of the tricky things here is that these conditionals include information about the odds ratio. And so every time I look at an odds ratio for conditionals, they give me back the odds ratio for the original table. And so I'm always working with multiple odds ratios if I'm working with a conditional. And this is why we get this heavily constraining structure. So there are a bunch of issues that people have looked at. If I gave you a margin and I gave you something and said it's a conditional, when can I put them together and actually construct a joint distribution? Or if I gave you two conditional things and said they were conditionals, when do they do it? Well, there are a lot of issues about how to put things together, but zeros in tables, which are the degeneracies that we normally think about, are not degeneracies when they come to the tables of counts. And so looking at what happens on the boundaries of the simplex leads to a very interesting set of characterizations in algebraic geometry terms. Secondly, if I'm interested in partial specifications, how do I get the possible values of all the tables with that partial specification? And can I put distributions over them in different ways, and how do I generate those? And the answer is from bases that come from the algebraic geometry. So here's a simple example. In the 2x2 table, it's well known that for any one cell, look at the 1-1 cell, it's bounded above by the minimum of its marginal totals, and those upper bounds induce a lower bound on every cell, and that lower bound takes, in the 2x2 table, that form. Actually, that's true for i/j tables, that formula without any change. The same idea works for partial specifications for non-negative counts, not just probabilities, and you can generalize exploiting all of the algebraic geometry structure. And the upper and lower bounds begin to take more and more complicated form, and understanding them comes from the geometry. If I give you now the probability of y given x and the probability of y, it isn't necessarily true that you get a unique table. So suddenly we begin to get partial specifications when I mix margins and conditionals. And for an i/2 table, it's possible to get a unique specification. But I can also get ranges of values, and I'll just show you a formula because you can get them in closed form, but it's sort of non-trivial to write them down. To write it down in high dimensions, it's impossible. But in two dimensions, you can get a sense of what's going on. So that was 2x2 tables, and I said I looked at them because I can put my arms around the geometry. But once the dimensionality starts to grow, you have to think differently. And so I can do the same kinds of representation in a log linear form. Now, instead of looking at odds ratios, I look at ratios of odds ratios or generalized odds ratios. And all the parameters take that form, and there's the Hadamard-like representation for them. And that means that I can now begin to look at the corresponding algebraic geometry structures at ideals and at Markov bases for them. And we've really been doing that in a variety of different forms. So there's a whole variety of interesting mathematical and statistical questions that follow from this. When are subsets of odds ratios implied by the conditionals? When I take some margins and conditionals and put them together, when do I get back simply margins, which is what I thought I was going to get when I started to do this work? And the answer is there's a well-known condition that comes out of the theory of directed acyclic graphs called the Wermuth condition. And when it holds, I get back margins only. That's important for bounds. When the combinations don't reduce to margins, how do you get bounds? How could you generate the range of all possible values given some margins and conditionals? We do this by generating a Markov basis that allows us to move from a known table to all possible known tables with these constraints. And you traverse them using a Monte Carlo Markov chain kind of algorithm till you exhaust the list. What are the practical partial specifications from subsets of these? Well, they're these higher dimensional geometric structures like the ones I described. And in particular, what are the partial specifications based on marginals and conditionals? And I'll illustrate those briefly in a second. So this ties to a lot of literature, both mathematics and statistics. What I've been showing you are pictures of Segre varieties and their generalizations. And the kinds of models we look at are represented by intersections of Segre varieties. That's what these models look like. You get explicit formulas for bounds with these nice specifications, and parallel results on Markov bases show up because all the bases involve quadratics. Regular graphs decompose into pieces, and that allows us to do things. And there are ties to the literature on causal models here that we've only begun to exploit a little bit. So here, I'm going to go back to the example before I end the first part. And what I've done is I've simply given you the bounds that correspond to fixing a three-way margin, a three-way margin, and a two-way margin, which correspond to an interesting model for clinical trials that focuses on the effect of treatment on the response. That's the key feature of this. And there's some other links between the other pair of variables, center and status, with response, but these don't interact with treatment. And what you see is that in this particular case, the upper and lower bounds resulting from partial specification given these margins lead to relatively tight inferences about the cells. This is a clinical trial where we know a population structure, and so there are people in the confidentiality literature that would argue that we've got to be really careful when we come down to these cells, where the original cell counts were three, but where I'm now getting relatively tight bounds. One of the interesting features here that's relevant to large sparse tables, which drives my real interest, is that when you put enough constraints on a table by giving a bunch of margins, sometimes zero counts end up being constrained to be zero. And this happens a lot in high dimensions, and understanding that is some of my current research. I can do this example with some conditionals. And in particular, if I look at the marginal total for the response, center, and status, and compare it with the conditional for response, center, and status, just to let you know that conditionals are different than marginals, you actually can count the numbers of tables as a result of the new computational algebraic geometry. And they're close, but those are real differences. It means that there's more points out there, and the question is, how does that grow as we get into high dimensions? And does it make sense to be able to relax from margins to conditionals in computing bounds? We really do get our bases. So there's an example of a computer-generated basis for that conditional. And it's not a 0-1 matrix, which is the traditional thing we normally see in statistics. So let me finish part one and move to the other part. So what I gave you was some different characterizations for simple models for tables of counts, and pointed out ties to a bunch of different statistical and mathematical pieces. And the partial specifications are really where most of my research is going on. It ties to understanding models, and it ties to disclosure limitation. And I used a small example for that. So now I want to shift to a larger set of problems. And I'm going to shift models as a consequence. One of the things that I did very shortly after I left Toronto is I started to work with very large contingency tables. The one that I was introduced to as a graduate student was a problem that grew out of the National Halothane Study, comparing five anesthetics, two genders, five age groups, 10 risk categories, 25 hospitals, and you can see how the dimensionality grew. It was a very large, sparse table. And log linear model methods were invented, essentially, for that, to work with those problems. But they don't always work well. And what I'm going to describe is a set of problems where they didn't work well, and we had to sort of shift gears. And they're basically problems where the models play a different role and effectively play a clustering role. And I'm looking for underlying data patterns, which is common with what I had before. And I'm going to give you two very large-scale, relatively large-scale examples, one on disability data and the other the words and references in five volumes of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. So here's the disability example. The National Long-Term Care Survey was first conducted in 1982 and then repeated on the same people who survived in 84, again in 89, again in 94. The data we've got only run up to 94, but it was done again in 99, and they're in the field now gathering data again. When people die, they're replaced by a new cohort, age 65. And so for any cross-section, for any point in time, there's an effort to estimate the full population structure, but also to follow people across time. And we're interested in people's ability to function as they get older. And we do this through activities of daily living and instrumental activities of daily living. And we've singled out for this particular example a series of dichotomous questions that people are asked, whether or not they can eat by themselves, whether or not they can get in and out of bed, and you can sort of see how these go. And some of them involve not just physical motion, but also cognitive functioning. So disability is not just a physical thing. In the sense of how some of these things function. Here's the second example I mentioned before what it was. We have 5 years of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. We have every word, and we have every reference uniquely coded. We looked only at the abstracts, but there's nothing that requires that we did only that. It was a matter of how to get started. We also looked only at the biological science articles, but they make up 92% of the journal, so that's not a big restriction. And they're organized according to 19 subtopics. They're very traditional subtopics. Ecology, genetics, psychology. Psychology is both a biologic science and a social science, according to this. So we've got the biologic science version. There are 39,000 different words that show up in these abstracts. And there are 77,000 plus references. So those are the data points. Somebody was asking at lunch, what's the dimensionality here? Well, at one level, the dimensionality is driven by the numbers of articles, the number of different words, or maybe the dictionary that includes these words, because you want to allow for words that haven't been used yet, and this collection of references. And you can see how the models are going to get complicated if I try to capture all of them. So traditional mixture models assume that any object comes from exclusively one out of a collection of groups. And I'm going to distinguish between the traditional model and ours by using G for the traditional grouping. But it's possible that attributes for objects have mixed origins. So individual responses in an attitude survey could be thought of as coming from multiple groups. And the words may correspond to multiple topics. And so we need to think about mixed membership. The same models I'm going to be describing have application in genetics, in a variety of machine learning contexts, and in some marketing contexts. We have data from all of these. Peanut butter sales are the example that we have data for. And here, it's going to be very crucial to use a hierarchically structured model, and it's going to just be natural to be Bayesian with this. So that simply means everything has a distribution. The notion that you simply have a parameter and focus on it will make no sense when there's virtually an infinite number of parameters to deal with. And so the hierarchical structure and the Bayesian structure is a way to control the numbers of parameters. And I'm going to represent membership by weighted combinations, and I'm going to introduce four levels of assumption. So at the first level, I'll think of some subpopulations or topics or aspects, and I'm going to observe a response pattern for it, and it'll be characterized by a distribution. When I talk about frequency data, both of my examples were frequency data, but of a different sort than the kind I showed you before, and I'm going to be able to have a structure that puts in arbitrary probability distributions, although similar ones to the usual categorical cases will be used in my two examples, like binomial and multinomial. And then I'll get different response patterns that are independent within each subpopulation. Now I want to come up to the unit level, and every unit is going to be characterized by its membership score. So there's going to be a probability vector for every unit. And given a membership score, responses will be treated as independent. So the thing that's driving this model is I'm getting rid of what looked like all the interactions in the other model, and then I'm going to put them back in implicitly through the back door. So then a unit's conditional probability is represented by a mixture across those subpopulations. And here's the, and then I can combine this by thinking of a way to generate this. First, I draw a latent classification for a unit, and then I look at the distribution of the x values given that latent value, and I average over the latent value, getting it out, and that's what gives the mixture. And here's the dependence, because what I'm going to assume is that those membership scores come from a distribution. And in statistics, when you put distributions on parameters, that mixing turns out to induce dependence. And it induces an interesting dependent structure here. And then finally, I get different kinds of replications. I get different kinds of characteristics, words and references, or and different numbers of replications of those in an article, or in the case of the disability data, J is equal to 16 because I had 16 different characteristics, and then I do a final mixing through integration over that distribution. So the key thing here is that for the survey data, this is a model that's kicked around but not being well understood until put in this context. There I've got binomial distributions that I'm tucking in. And the tie of the first part of the talk is you can study the geometry by looking at 2x2 tables, even though we're in high dimensions here. And you can begin to see how these models produce geometry that differs from the log-linear model with a different kind of dependence. So here are the data. It's a 2 to the 16th contingency table, so this is sort of a way station to big tables. And it's very large and very sparse. Any statistician would tell you how large and sparse this is. 62,000 of the cells are zero. And all the rest are small except for about 25, and we'll look at those. So there are about 25 big cells, and the rest small cells or zero cells. You can see by looking at this graph that people tend to be either healthy, and then there's a bunch of people who are really sick, and then it's unclear sort of what this middle part is. But the reason you can't use log linear models for this is that they never capture all the people who are healthy. They always underrepresent that so significantly that they're just wrong. And so this model is being driven by characterizing, in part, the two extremes. We fit this using Monte Carlo Markov chain. That's where you're led. And we've done this with 2, 3, 4, and 5 different profiles or groups. They get increasingly complex. They're still not capturing with 5 groupings what's going on. But the number of parameters for 5 groups is very substantial. And we look at a whole variety of different parameter estimates. Here's the big cells in the table. So these are the 24 largest cells. There's all the healthy people on the top line. And you can see that as we hit 5 groups, we're getting close to getting that cell characterized, but we're still a long way from doing well. And we think that we probably need to be up near k equals 8, but that's computationally difficult to do in this kind of setting using the full Bayesian structure. We've looked at this in a variety of ways in terms of fitting models, and it looks like we still need to be adding parameters. That's all this really means. So let me shift to the other example, and then sort of, because it has some interesting features that are not represented in the first one, I said, here I have J equals 2, and the counts vary from document to document, both in words and references. Those are the 19 official topics. And you can be in more than one topic, but it's really hard. So of the 20,000, whatever the total number of articles is, there are only 100-some-odd joint topics. But you can now see, the numbers... it's 12,000, 11,981, and only 179 are doubly listed. And one of the interesting questions is, if authors really told you what was in their articles, how many multiply listed articles would you see in light of the inherent shifting of fields over time, even in that 5-year period? Here's two examples. The fading makes it virtually impossible. But it's an example which, if you read really carefully, would look like behavioral economics, but in fact shows up under ecology in modeling. And a second one, this is sort of the typical words that you have to deal with. And it's every word that's on the screen here in the title, and in location and every reference that gets listed. This is impossible to fit using the Bayesian structure. Why? Because there's nothing in closed form that you can do, and you need a variety of approximations to this. What we assume is that the words in the abstracts are randomly drawn from a bag of words. This is a very naive model, I want to emphasize. I'll tell you more sophisticated ones at the break. And a bag of references, that is, there's a bag of references and I randomly pick references. And I do this conditional on membership score, so that gets differential distribution. And the generative model has multinomials with a Dirichlet distribution. So it looks like pieces of traditional categorical data modeling. And the key thing is to keep control over parameters. We put distributions over the parameters in the Dirichlet. This answers Jacques' question at lunch, how big is big? In dimensionality, every time I grow a category, I'm adding 39,000 parameters for words, 77,000 for references, and one Dirichlet parameter. And the key to the hierarchical structure is I control that. But I have to integrate all those nuisance parameters out of the problem. And it's that integration that's the hard part. And so we have a whole host of approximations that people try for this kind of problem, and we use one of them. We used a variational approximation that Mike Jordan and his students have spent a lot of time on. We also tried a different version of an approximation, and they gave essentially the same answer. But we're actually able to pull out parameter estimates for the aspects, and we're able to get a membership vector for every article. So that original first article I showed you was for an article in evolution, and it lumps up on one of the aspects. We've got 8 topics in this particular version I'm showing you, whereas the second one, which was in immunology, lumps up on 2 different aspects, and it's clearly a mixed comes through loud and clear that that should be a dual topic article. And we have a new set of categories for the journal. We've done this for K equals 10, and we've looked at virtually everything that you can get as output. And in particular, here's an example of looking graphically at what happens as we increase the number of topics. Our notion was to control it just like an editor would want to control the number of topics in the journal. And you can see darker means where things load up. And it turned out that when we looked at this for K equals 8, it made more sense than when we looked at it for K equals 10. And so we reported here. Somebody did exactly the same kind of model for words only with a slightly different set of assumptions. And they turn out to matter enormously because they get K equals 300. And they were able to compute the posterior distribution by running it for 30 hours on the San Diego supercomputer. We did it on a PC. And the question is, at what level do you want to describe topics? Clearly, they're at a level of granularity that's different than ours. And so we've begun to devise a variation on this where the topics themselves have a hierarchical structure with mixed membership. And that means that I have interlocking kinds of Bayesian models for this. So, in the second part, I'd sort of switch gears totally And this reflects the bias that I now have coming from my appointment with the computer scientists. They think nothing about going to high dimensions of this sort, and my colleagues there would call this unsupervised learning, because that's their name for clustering. And we've introduced soft or mixed membership characterizations here. And the interesting feature here is that I've gone from simple categories, in this case, to new structures, words and references. Mike Jordan and his students have used pieces of images. They can be genes on the genome. And the idea is simple. The estimation is complicated. The computation is something we would not have dreamed about. And understanding it geometrically is a new challenge. It's an alternative to the log linear representation when data form a contingency table, and so there is actually a connection between part one and part two. Nancy. Markov bases are simple versions of bases. The thing about algebraic geometry, which I'm still learning, is that there's dozens of kinds of bases. And so what you can generate easily is bases with particular structures like Grubner bases. But then you want to look at them and say, this just spewed out things in an arbitrary form, and we like minimal structures with nice representations. And in our case, they're Markov bases. And for most of the log linear model problems, they begin with zeros, ones, and minus ones, which look a lot like the design matrices that we do in analysis of variance structure. Unfortunately, once the models get more complex, you get non-simple representation. And then whether it's Markov or something else may or may not matter.
Your little simplicial pictures in the first part,
yeah.
The actual surfaces were ruled surfaces. Is that going to be characteristic of these things, or is it just...
It's characteristic of log linear models.
Oh, okay. But
indeed, that is the characterization of log linear models in the simplexes, as far as I can tell.
Okay. But in your part two, where you were getting away
from... They're not.
They could be any surface.
They have a different structure. And I have a conjecture about what's going to give the good geometry for that. And that is, I think we need an approximate geometry. And Bernd Sternfels has convinced me that the right kind of approximation is probably tropical geometry approximation. But it seems natural for this because you're dealing with log probabilities. Wait.